Hi guys, I'm Nate Granzo. I'm here with the Ultimate Predator founder, possessor of what is perhaps the best beard known to mankind, Mr. Carl Hiley. I'm the editor-in-chief of the site. And we're going to give this whole podcast thing a try. We've got a few topics today that we want to cover. First, I think it'd be wise to have a little bit of introduction, Carl. I think we need to talk about your background and why you decided you want to start the site. We had talked about this for years leading up to this. Why don't you give us a little background, a little bit of your background in the outdoors, a little bit of why you felt that there was a need for this site.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I guess first of all, I'm what they call a late onset hunter, right? I didn't grow up hunting. Nobody else in my family hunts, but, we were always active in the outdoors, right? So I grew up going on backpacking trips throughout North America, all over from down the Guadalupe Mountains of Texas up to, Banff and Jasper and the Canadian Rockies and Mount Rainier out in Washington and things like that. So I was always out in the outdoors. I was always fishing. I mean, I was a fanatical fisherman.
Yeah, you got me into that. Yeah, we spent many a summer back in high school fishing. You showed me the way.
Yeah, I was actually, I remember when I was 16, I was fortunate enough that, grew up in an upper middle class family where, when my sisters and I turned 16, our parents would get us a vehicle, not like a new one, but, we get a vehicle so we could drive around. And I remember when I was 15, right before I got my license, I was like, I don't want a vehicle. I want a boat. I don't want a car. Never mind. How am I going to get this boat into, these different lakes without a vehicle? But, whatever, I was young and dumb. I wanted a boat to go fishing. But anyway, so I was, I loved the outdoors. I was always outdoors, but nobody in my family hunted. So I didn't grow up hunting. I was interested, but I had nobody to show me the way and getting into hunting, if you don't have somebody taking you, like actively bringing you, it's really difficult and intimidating to get into. You're like, there's all these rules. How do I find what I'm after?
Even the cost of entry on hunting, even something locally, I mean, without getting too lofty, going on some exotic big game hunt. I mean, just strictly, even if you want to get into something like up here, waterfowl hunting or pheasant hunting or whatever, it would be... It's prohibitively expensive for someone who has no clue what it is that it takes to even get started. You don't even know what you need, what equipment you need, but you do know it's going to cost some money to get started. And I'm just saying that's an aspect too, absolutely, in addition to not having the access to the resources.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. That's definitely, a thing that a lot of people struggle with and have to consider. I was younger at the time, so I didn't really have a conception of money, right? And where do I go? What do I do? And then, okay, I kill an animal. Then what do I do? Right. Like, now I have this dead thing. What do I do with it? I was interested in it, but it was just like, it felt unattainable, right? I didn't have anyone to take me and I didn't know what to do. Eventually you took me out duck hunting.
Yep.
Right. You know, and that was awesome. I had a blast doing that. And I, fell in love with
you took to that. You took to that more than anybody I've ever hunted with. I mean, I remember distinctly too, it was late in the season too. So it was already really cold. Not a lot of ducks flying. And you were like, it is 4 a.m. It's time to go. We're doing this, right? We're going back out third day in a row. Yep. Up. Ready to go. And we had another guy with us at the time. And after the first day of slogging out there, he's like, you know what? You guys go ahead. I'm going to sleep in.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I loved it. And so, we did that. And I look forward to duck hunting every year. But I was interested in getting into big game hunting. But for some, logistical reasons and whatever, you guys couldn't. I couldn't go deer hunting with you and your family.
Well, yeah, part of it is that when you don't own land, and we haven't, we've never right. owned hunting land, it's always kind of a beggar type situation where we have friends that, it's okay if we come, but then it was, it's a big ask even when, my dad would bring the kids along, me and my brother, it was still like, they're not really part of the group, you haven't directly invited them, and so it But yeah, that's making excuses maybe, but that's part of it. It is really difficult with especially big game hunting.
Yep.
People are very defensive about who hunts their land, who they have coming with them.
Yeah, and I think reasonably so. It's totally understandable, you know, and so...
But it's a barrier.
I mean, yeah, right. And, you know, I never felt put off or anything about it. Like, I totally get it. The friend of a friend, like, kind of thing is, you know, I get it, right?
Right.
But so I couldn't go with you guys, and so I had nobody to take me deer hunting, right, and show me the ropes. And deer hunting, you know, big game hunting especially is a place where it's okay, even if I get one, right? You know, my sister has a farm just outside of the Twin Cities where, you know, I was like, well, I felt pretty reasonably confident, like, I could probably get a deer, but then what do I do?
Right.
But I mean, that's like, you have this large animal dead on the ground. Now what do you do with it?
Right.
You know, and it's like, that's a really intimidating thing for someone who has no idea what they're doing and not like a lot of background in hunting, you know? So then finally I just kind of nutted up and did a whole bunch of research and figured it out and just went and did it.
Right.
Which was actually really fun. I really enjoyed that. Just kind of learning and teaching it to myself. It was really rewarding.
But that's not necessarily something everybody's equipped to do or prepared to do. It's like I've told you before, I commend you for having the stones to just say, you know what, you have the resolution, I'm going to do this thing, and then you do it. And most people in life are not quite that way. Everybody talks about, you know, I'd love to get into hunting, I'd love to try it. But there's just enough barriers between them and actually getting out there and doing it, and enough of that intimidation to really slow somebody down that very few people, I think, would take that kind of plunge without there being somebody to mentor them, like you said, somebody to kind of guide them.
Yep, exactly, exactly. And so that's kind of where the genesis of The Ultimate Predator happened was, you know, looking at, well, what were the challenges to getting into hunting? You know, what were the struggles I had as somebody who didn't have... I know a family member who would take me and didn't have access. And you know, there's a lot of people like that, right? A lot of people who grow up in the suburbs or in the cities where they'd be interested in going hunting, but they're from the suburbs and in the cities. They don't, nobody in their family hunts. They don't know where to go. They don't have anywhere to go other than, you know, public land,
which is crowded
100 miles away. And every 10 feet, there's a hunter and, you know, another stand. And so it's really intimidating. And how do we help, you know, reduce that, the difficulty and the stress level associated with getting into hunting. And then on top of that, I went elk hunting for the first time last year, and I got really, really frustrated trying to learn about how to hunt elk, right? Sights are either, they're these really broad general things that give you basically useless information.
You or know. Information that's just so obvious that it's like, not insightful.
Exactly.
In a meaningful way.
Buy a hunting tag.
Yeah.
Yes.
Knew that.
Okay. Like, good. I mean, yeah. I don't think it should be ignored, right? Because we don't want people just going out not buying a hunting license.
Obviously not. But, like, how do I approach buying a hunting license? You know, what are the salient details for how do I even accomplish that simple bullet point that you just kind of gloss over, assuming
right.
that the reader knows how to do that.
Yeah, yeah. But where I got really frustrated was, you know, there was a lot of, they'd be like, oh, planning your hunting trip, you know, and they'd cover things like getting a license. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, it's worth covering. But I'm looking for, like, now how do I start finding where I want to hunt? Like, how do I pick my spot on the landscape? Where do I find elk? And so all of the articles and podcasts and everything, they're all like, planning your trip, buy a license. Or they're like, here's how to dog this elk up the mountain, you know, bugle at it. And then when it bugles back, make sure you cut it off with your return bugle while you chase it up the mountain. And then once you get over the ridge, you know, just kind of peek up, you know, it's like all these super advanced things where I'm like, how do I even find an elk?
Right. Right.
Like all that stuff.
Let's start there.
It's great information, but it's useless if I can't even find where to go.
Right.
Like if I need a starting point, right? And so I got really frustrated that I couldn't find anywhere that would talk about that kind of stuff. Like what type of habitat do they actually live in? Like, where do you find them?
Right.
You know, what are their habits and behaviors? beyond like, okay, I found an area where they are. And, you know, like, again, it was really advanced stuff where it's like, they're going to do this if you do this, if you do that. And I'm like, again, how do I find the areas they're going to be in, predict, you know, what type of habitat they're going to be in at what type of year, as opposed to how do I actually kill the animal once I'm there?
Right.
Right. There's a lot of that. How do you actually kill the animal once I'm there? And a lot of really, really basic buy license.
Right.
You know, that in between ground of I need to learn how to hunt them wasn't really there. And I got really frustrated. So that's the other, you know, place is learning about the animals you're trying to hunt, how to find them, what kind of skills do you need to be able to get to them and then and hunt them.
And to have it all consolidated in one place, right? Because it's not that we live in this era of vast information. I mean, limitless information on the internet, but the amount of legwork it requires to be able to find all that. And it seems like no one site kind of captures that full progression, that development from total beginner to being in a position where you can actually successfully pull off one of these hunts.
Yep, absolutely. And that applies doubly. So if you want to have just like one place you can go to find information about multiple different species.
Right.
Right. You can find a place, you know, a lot of them are maybe like a selling a course or something or whatever on one species. And so you can find that, but again, it's an organization
that's like, you know, strictly focused on elk.
Exactly.
Which is great if that's all you're interested in. But, you know, in most cases, at least the people I've met in this industry, the people that I've met in this field, there's a little bit broader interest in. And frankly, there's a lot of crossover, too. I mean, a lot of information that would be practical for hunting, you know, mountain goats, for instance, may apply well in the field for hunting elk. Or who knows? I mean, there's having that repository of information can't hurt. Especially when it's cross-disciplinary.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And so I wanted to have a place where we can take people from, I'm just getting into hunting, or I'm just hunting this species for the first time, you know, so that whatever the species is, there's information that they can find and access in a meaningful way to go out and have a good experience in their hunt. And then start from there. And build them all the way up to, I've been doing this for 30 years. I've had a lot of, you know, I've killed a lot of elk, but, you know, I want to learn, I want to take it to the next level. I want to be even better. I want to learn more. Because, you know, I always want to be better at everything I'm doing. So, you know, we always want to be learning. So I want a place where people can go from, hey, I'm just starting, all the way through to, you know, I'm basically an expert in this, but there's always more to learn.
I think with this format, it would be a good opportunity for us to kind of look at some of the articles that we've published on the site. And we've already got a number of really interesting articles up there, some of which you've written, some I've written. We've had several staff writers that have contributed some really interesting pieces so far. But taking a look at just even this past week, one in particular that I think is of some interest, or at least got quite a bit of, invited a lot of controversy, is the one that I had written about WDM Bell, who was a big game hunter back at the turn of the century in the 1900s. And the article was supposed to kind of take a look at his book, which was a little bit autobiographical, and try to find some lessons that could apply to today's hunter. And in a lot of cases, I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that WDM, this Bell fellow, was what I would classify as like a responsible hunter. Granted, the times were completely different. This is early 1900s. The environment was different. The culture that surrounded hunting was completely different. But he killed to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of elephants. He created kind of a commodity. He was an ivory hunter. I mean, that's essentially what he was about. But his insight into the hunting of the world's largest land animal is fascinating. I mean, even if you don't agree with his methods or the mentality behind it, he did have quite a bit of really unique practical experience when it comes to field work. And we tried to kind of present that in a way that people could at least glean something from it without condemning or condoning. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, something that's happened that far back in history, we can learn from it. But the, you know, that it was just a completely different time. We can't necessarily apply today's morality or our perspective on conservation and hunting to what was completely alien to those people at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be practices that we have today that in 100 years people, I can't believe they did that.
Right.
Well, but that's just how it was right now.
That's the nature of
it. That's where we were at right now, you know.
Yep. But what we did find was that when this article posted, there were a number of people that kind of had that immediate knee-jerk reaction, which I think a lot of people have. At least there's kind of this misunderstanding that surrounds the idea of elephant hunting. And I don't think most of them that were taking issue with this article probably didn't read it and didn't realize that the article itself wasn't condoning elephant hunting. It was an analysis of this, you know, 100-year-old text.
Yeah.
But notwithstanding, it does invite kind of an interesting topic, the idea that, you know, elephant hunting does still take place today, just in a very limited form. It's very expensive, prohibitively expensive for most people. But it is extremely controversial, and people reacted very strongly to that article, I think. But what was your read on that as far as...
I think the biggest, I guess, where that stems from for people is I think people look at elephant hunting and they immediately think trophy hunting.
Right.
And that all you're there for is that you're there to kill this animal so you can hang something on the wall. And that's it. You kill it, cut the head off, and
of course,
leave everything to rot.
Can they even do that? I think their importation laws pertaining to ivory, I don't think that that's even, outside of a photo, I don't think these hunters can take any part of the elephant back with them, can they?
You know, I don't know. I'm sure
it probably varies by country.
Yeah, and there's probably, you know, certificates you can get through various organizations to say that this is a, you know, legally hunted and imported and
sure,
whatever. You know, just like you go hunt a bear in Idaho, you have to register. You know, you kill the black bear, you have to take it to a station, they remove a tooth from it, and, you know, it's proof that it's been registered and that, you know, it was legally taken. It's not a poached animal and so on and so forth. So there's probably some things like that where you could get trophies back of some sort or another. You know, I don't know for sure.
That's entirely beside the point. I'm sorry, that's a tangent. You know, like you were saying, though, that the sentiment prevails that if you're hunting elephant, it must strictly be just for the sake of, you know, just mercilessly killing an animal without any...
Yeah, for a trophy or experience or whatever.
Right.
You know, and I think a place that probably is a place where, you know, hunters, the hunting community in general, hasn't done the best job, starting to do a better job of really focusing on why are people hunting besides antlers or trophies or whatever, you know? You know, that the benefits, the food that comes with it, the community experiences, what, you know, and especially over in places like Africa or, you know, in Tajikistan, the Himalayas and things like that, for Marco Polo sheep or whatever, the benefit to the communities that these large fees to hunt these animals are creating, right? You know, they're doing a lot for the community. They're building schools. They're building community play fields, all these types of things. And what kind of impact that has with the relation between the locals and the animals.
Because it assigns an obvious value to the animal, too. I mean, obviously, the big concern right now, especially as it relates to elephants specifically, is the pursuit of ivory, right? Mm-hmm. The illegal ivory trade, it's become this... there's a global awareness now, which is good, that this is clearly an issue. It's a very prevailing issue right now, especially in the country, or in the continent. Throughout the continent, they've been having this issue. And I think that people tend to conflate legal hunting with this illicit craft, or like this illicit trade of ivory. So whereas what it really does is it assigns a value to the animals that surpasses its value on the black market, right? Or one would think that it would be more beneficial for them to try to preserve it and protect these animals, to keep them from falling into the hands of poachers, because there is a value assigned to their community.
It, I mean, it provides the incentive to for the communities and the guides, professional hunters, to stop poachers. You know, if the animals have no value to the local community besides, well, I mean, so there's kind of two levels to it. There's one, they just kill the animals for food. And also elephants can be destructive.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. So they would just kill them just so they don't
destroy their crops,
or, you know, whatever. But so between that and, you know, the food, they'd kill them for that, and they wouldn't, the elephants are a nuisance to them. So they would have no regard for the, you know, health of the herd or the ecosystem, with regard to elephants. But then also they wouldn't care if there's poachers hunting them for the ivories for the very same reasons. You know, without there being a financial incentive for them to do that. And then tied in with that, there has to be resources to prevent poachers, right? There has to be people out in the field doing anti-poaching activities to catch poachers, right? I mean, these poachers are serious. It's their job, right? I mean, they're willing to kill people for it, right? So, I mean, these people out patrolling for these poachers have to be armed, they have to be trained, right? I mean, it's their job, right? And so these people have to get paid, and they have to have the equipment, and all of that costs money. And if there's not funds coming in, there's not dollars coming in from, you know, Western hunters coming in to, you know, harvest a bull once in a while, then it just isn't going to happen.
Right. Well, and one of the things that got posited on social media about this article in particular was that taking the hunting of elephants weakens the integrity of the herd, or like the it's the health, the overall health of the herd. And that's, generally speaking, that's completely the opposite. It's untrue. The bulls that are being harvested tend to be older. They tend to be beyond reproductive age, and they can actually be a detriment to the herd if they aren't dealt with. So the culling, the hunting is very, very strategic, very specific for that very reason. It's not intended to be just this arbitrary, you have a tag, you can take any bull.
Right, right. And so I think just to kind of step back a second and say, the argument that was being made was that harvesting elephants out of the population, you're reducing, you're making the genetic pool smaller because there's fewer elephants to reproduce. And so long-term, you're making them less viable, making them subject to inbreeding and whatever, I think is
that was the general,
is what the argument was. But yeah, just like you were saying, the animals that get hunted, they're these old bulls that actually can't reproduce anymore. But they're still the biggest, baddest MFers out there.
Right.
And they're keeping the younger elephant, the younger bull elephants who can reproduce, from breeding with the female. So these old bulls are actually a detriment to increasing the population and increasing the gene pool. So it's actually the opposite way around of what was being posited. Now, I mean, it's, I think, an understandable, or I guess maybe it's counterintuitive to what most people would think. And so that's kind of where that argument came from. But yeah, these are very targeted hunts that are done with the purpose of increasing the herd health.
Which, from the research that you've done on it, it has been successful, right? I mean, at least it looks like the trajectory, it kind of collectively, elephants are making a resurgence. There are efforts being made that are producing results. Elephant health, they're not endangered. They're vulnerable. On the whole, the efforts that are being made are showing some success in that region. But I think that there's still that kind of pervasive misconception that's being floated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The IUCN lists, you know, indicates that the African elephant has an increasing population trajectory. So the health of the herds, you know, is getting better.
And I'm sure that varies per country too. I mean, that there's so many factors to consider with something like this. It's not a simple issue, obviously. I mean, if you're talking about sociopolitical conditions in various African countries, the health of the herd in South Africa or Congo or wherever may be completely different than it is in Sudan.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, for a long time, elephant hunting has been legal in, South Africa, right? But, a place like Botswana, it wasn't until just recently, I think last year, it was that they lifted the ban on hunting.
Sure.
But I guess kind of in defense of the idea that hunting is helping elephant herds, even the New York Times in 2017 published an article that, they're like, hunt elephants to save them. Some countries see no other choice, right, is the headline of the article. So people, countries have tried these other tactics and they're just finding them ineffective. But then places where hunting has been, legal and has been bringing in these funds that provides the infrastructure and the equipment and the training to have these anti-poaching units out there, they're finding that the populations are improving there, that they're having success.
All right, let's move on. We've got, I think, one more section that I thought would be kind of a fun thing to do with the podcast. Just dumb ideas that are poorly executed. And we don't have to be mean about it. We don't have to pick on any individuals. But there's a lot of misconceptions, a lot of mistakes that are made in the field. Some of them are funny. I mean, I know we've both independently made numerous mistakes that are comical looking back on it. But at the moment, seemed like a really bright idea.
Yeah.
So I thought we could maybe make that a recurring thing. And I propose for this episode, we discuss something that the National Park Service in Wyoming and the Grand Tetons has done that I personally think is a dumb idea that's been poorly executed. And namely, to set the groundwork here, there are bighorn sheep in the Grand Tetons that it's a fairly small population, and they have been suffering from kind of an invasive quality of these mountain goats that have moved into that area. And mountain goats they can carry pathogens that the same that are carried by domestic sheep and goats that can be transmitted to the Rocky Mountain goats. So there's been an effort to remove the mountain goats from that area, right?
So there's bighorn sheep that are native.
Right.
And then there's, and bighorn sheep are really susceptible to this type of pneumonia that, and it's always fatal when they get it. And it's highly contagious within a herd that they can get from sheep, right?
Right.
Yeah, and these
mountain goats.
I'm sorry.
Right, they're susceptible from the goats, and the goats have moved in from an adjacent area that they were. I think it was I have it written here. The Backpacker.com had written that biologists believe that the park's goats originally migrated from the Snake River Range, where Idaho's Department of Fish and Game introduced them back in the 60s in hopes of kind of creating a population for hunters to pursue. And they've just spread, as is the nature of game. So they're at kind of a crucial point right now, a tipping point where these mountain goats, if no action is taken at all, the mountain goats could potentially kind of push out or damage that already precarious population of bighorn sheep in that area. And the population could just get out of control if nothing is done.
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm advocating for nothing to be done, but the way that the National Park Service has approached this is that they've essentially decided to hire a contract crew to come in on helicopters with shotguns and to wipe out, completely call, eradicate this particular herd of goats in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that's not effective, and ultimately it probably will do exactly what they need, which is to eradicate. I'm sure they'll do a fine job of that.
Yeah.
But when asked what they plan to do with the animals that are taken, the National Park Service just said, well, we might try to recover a few for research, but ultimately we're going to leave them where they lie, right? Mm-hmm. This is strictly a means to an end, a way to reduce this population to solve this problem. My question is, why would you not open that up to a limited hunting season? Why would you not make it available for hunters to come in who would appreciate the hunt, for one. I mean, can you imagine hunting mountain goats in the Grand Teton? I'd be all about that.
You're right.
That's money that would come in that you could put toward other conservation programs, could fund innumerable efforts on the conservation front.
Yeah.
Rather than spending taxpayer dollars to hire a helicopter service to come in and wipe them out. It just seems like it's such a ham-fisted thing handled so poorly. Like, why would that not have been an option? Because certainly the idea of hunters coming in and doing exactly that, coming in and taking these goats, they would appreciate the hunt. They would undoubtedly do it tactfully and responsibly, ethically, and they would be able to, you know, get meat from that. There's a number of benefits from this that are being wasted, I think, by approaching it with this, you know, this pursuit. What are your thoughts on that? I don't know. Maybe that's a little harsh to call that a dumb idea poorly executed, because actually it's executed very efficiently and almost like, you know, without any emotion at all. It's strictly a numbers game. They said, we're going to pay this price and we're going to wipe out this population. But it just seems as though it's a wasted opportunity.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, I mean, they did issue some hunting tags, didn't they?
Not to my knowledge. They may have. There's been a lot of back and forth on this because I think they changed the language somewhat. So it may not. They may include some of the hunters in that calling as part of that. The helicopter crews coming in. It could be qualified volunteers, I think was the phrase that they used, which kind of opens it up to potentially being hunting based. But from what I was reading, they're not going to waste any time with the tag aspect. They're not going to open it up to hunting. They're just going to have a service come in.
So there wasn't a hunting season already on them?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Because in that case, why wouldn't you have just expanded the number of tags or extended the season somewhat? I mean, there are ways that you can address this to ultimately reach the same result.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, any time that that there's an opportunity to have hunters resolve an issue versus having a professional wildlife services or somebody like that coming into it, that's ideal. With the national parks, though, I think it gets tricky. I don't know if they're allowed to allow hunting inside of the national park.
Well, from the research I was doing, it sounds like there are already programs like this around. In fact, in the Grand Teton National Parks, there's an elk reduction program that would have been more akin to what I was proposing with the hunters, but that was congressionally mandated. So it sounds like the National Park Service, when left to their own devices, they don't want to go down that route whenever possible.
Now, with that elk reduction, is that actually within the national park? Because there's also, right outside the Tetons, there's that National Elk Refuge,
which is a huntable territory with certain,
right,
I would imagine, limited amount of tags, right, for that.
Yeah,
that
exactly, area, right? Exactly. And so I wonder if that's part of that elk reduction program, you know, within the national park proper, or is it within the elk refuge that may be managed by the Forest Service or the Park Service?
And I don't have the answer to that. That's entirely possible. Yeah, that is a possibility too. And I do understand from the perspective of, and I know this has been brought up with like hunting coyotes, for instance, a similar thing where, you know, why would you resort to having a service come in or poisoning? You know, you hear about that all the time, where they poison off predators rather than allow hunters to take them like throughout the year. Yeah. Why not just take the licensure, like that aspect out of the equation? If you have a problem with a species, you could handle it in that way. But in a lot of cases from the research that's been done, they find that actually it doesn't necessarily have a lasting impact on the population of the predators. It just disperses them. It just drives them kind of the same thing with pigs. They've tried that with feral hogs in the South, where they have, you know, like a bounty on hogs.
Yep.
And they're finding that it's not adequate on its own to being able to keep up with how quickly they reproduce, and the hunting actually kind of pushes them out of a given area. It just sort of spreads the population. So I don't know if they're approaching it like that, where if they are even able to opening up to hunters. So say there are 150 goats and you want them all gone, and you issue say 200 tags and say, let's turn these guys loose and see what happens. It's entirely possible that they could get a fraction of the total number and then just drive the rest of them out into a different area. Yeah. In which case, you're still going to, if the problem persists, you're still going to have to hire that helicopter service to come finish the job, in which case, why didn't you just start there?
Right, and now you may have even made it harder to do.
Right. So if that is the case, and there are a lot of variables here that maybe I don't have the full story, but it seems to me on the face of it that other choices could have been made that may have facilitated the hunting in that region. And as we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast, the idea that there's such a limitation on hunters getting into hunting.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult to find places to hunt and to find game that's affordable to hunt. I mean, you look at any out-of-state tags at all. I mean, you're talking about elk hunting in Idaho. Mm-hmm. That's one of the more affordable out-of-state tags, and that's still, what, $500-$600?
Yeah, it's $500, a little under $500.
Sure, and you still have to get there. I mean, there's a major barrier of entry on big game. So if there's an opportunity like this where having people come in that may not otherwise have an opportunity to pursue that game, you know, you don't have to set the price extremely high. If the whole purpose is just to eradicate this population, there are opportunities that could help kind of promote hunting, help give opportunities to people who wouldn't have. These are lifetime hunts. I mean, that would be an extraordinary opportunity that are wasted by, you know, somebody kind of dispassionately dispatching these goats with a shotgun out of the door, going all apocalypse now on them out of the door of a helicopter.
Right.
I don't know. It seems a little bit ham-fisted to me.
Yep. Yeah, and you do make an interesting analogy with predator hunting. And one thing I wonder if something they were thinking about is, like, if they were doing that, making that comparison with predator hunting and saying, well, it's just not going to make a difference, it won't make a dent, we need to hire these people anyway. But people don't really hunt predators that much.
True.
Right? I mean, like in Idaho, when they opened their wolf season, you know, they had a defined quota and plan and things like that. And then after a few years, they just stopped even publishing a quota because not one time did their quota even get close to getting met.
Do you think that's because, I know wolves tend to be pretty elusive, at least in my experience. I for living in Minnesota my entire adult life, or the majority of it, living in the upper Midwest, it's not that wolves aren't around. I mean, I've heard them at night while I'm laying in my tent.
Yeah.
I have never actually seen one. And I know that that's not true. A lot of guys that deer hunt, they're like, no, I've had wolves come by. I tend not to, I've seen coyotes, but actually seeing wolves up close, they tend to be a little bit more wary in my experience anyway. So I don't know if maybe that's a factor or if it's, maybe you're right. Maybe there's just not as much of an interest in taking predators because, you know, sure, if you're a fur bear, you know, if you're trying to trap or something, then you see a little more value in it. But there's no, it's not like taking a deer where you can
fill people
the
aren't really like eating their coyotes, right? You know, right?
I should hope not.
and so I wonder if they were making that comparison and kind of got that false sense of, well, it's not going to make a difference,
right?
Because people aren't going to come and actually do it. But we're with this, with like a mountain goats, I mean, that's a difficult tag to get.
Yeah.
In like Montana or something, right?
Absolutely.
You have to apply for it for years to get a tag.
Get your preference points and start,
And working toward it. So in this case, there probably would have been a really high interest in it. So I don't know, how do you think they should have set it up or gone about it to, you know, make it accessible to hunters? And
And again, this might be showing my ignorance of the way that I'm sure there's a load of bureaucracy that follows something like this. I mean, it is the National Park Service. I'm sure they're hampered by a number of things that are outside my understanding or you know, my perception. Mm-hmm. So take from this what you will. But it just seems to me that if hunting is already taking place in the state and you have the Game and Wildlife Commission or whatever the organization is in that state that already handles tags, why couldn't you just hand that off? Why not just hand it off to them and say, all right, we have a problem with this population in this zone. Can you open this up for a limited season and just see what happens? And from what I was reading, it sounds like it's at a point where, yes, something needs to be addressed. Something needs to be done in order to mitigate an issue soon. If we didn't do anything, we could have a problem in a couple of years. It could be past a point of no return for the bighorn sheep. But if it's not that urgent, if you had the opportunity to open this up for a hunting season, a limited hunting season, and you could potentially knock that population down and keep it in check for another year. And if you find that, you know what, this didn't do the job, we didn't eradicate this group, we just managed to kind of take enough to keep the population in check, maybe then at that point you come back and you say, yeah, we're going to hire the service to completely do the job. We found that this, you know, we tried it the other way, it didn't work, and this is what we propose. But it just seems like this is kind of a leaping before you look, so to speak. It's just kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the issue, or jumping right into the most severe solution rather than trying to give opportunity to those who might be interested.
Yeah, absolutely. I think any time we can create more access and opportunity for hunters, that's a good thing. And we should at least try that if possible before hiring a professional services to just wipe out a herd of a game of a highly prized game animal.
I think that's the part that hurt me the most. It just seemed like it was such a waste, you know, a profound waste. There are so many people that would so eagerly jump into doing something like this, and they're so dismissive about it, you know, like, oh, we're not even going to try to collect them for research. We're not going to donate the carcasses, anything. It was just like, nope, we're going to go out there, slaughter them wholesale, and just leave them for the vultures to come and take care of. It seems very dispassionate, I guess.
I definitely see how and feel the kind of the frustration in that, you know, as a hunter.
And again, I don't think it's fair that obviously we're lobbing a lot of accusations here. We don't have the full picture. I'm sure that somebody from the National Park Service could probably illuminate this in a way that would justify why they decided to go this route. But at least on the face of it, the optics aren't great.
Right. Right. Well, maybe we can get somebody from the National Park Service on and we can.
I think it'd be good. Yeah, they can. Correct us on some of the misconceptions if they exist. Otherwise, I don't know. I think that's a warranted first episode of Dumb Ideas Poorly Executed. I think we can come up with a catchier name than that. Something that's a little less wordy. That seems a little bit clunky to me.
Yeah.
But we'll work on it. Not too bad for a first episode, I think. This was a lot of fun. I think we should do it again.
Absolutely.
All right, buddy.
Looking forward to it.
Sounds good. All right, guys. We appreciate you tuning in. We'll catch you soon.